advocated for is rather indefinite. I think that is par for the course as far as like, well, like we should expect that considering that this is a manifesto. It's trying to win people over to a particular ideology. And so when you have an indefinite group, it becomes easier to, it's sort of like making space for a particular person to side with that. So like, you know, starting the next section of truth. So right after lies comes truth, and it's just as short. Our civilization was built on technology. Our civilization is built on technology. Technology is the glory of human ambition and achievement, the spearhead of progress, and the realization of our potential. For hundreds of years, we properly glorified this until recently. I am here to bring the good news. We can advance to a far superior way of living and of being. We have the tools, the systems, the ideas. We have the will. It is time once again to raise the technology flag. It is time to be techno-optimist. So I go into this to say that this is the first instance where he's using the word our, right? And that our is trying to be as wide as possible because it wants to win over, and there's sort of like open seats for people to take, right? Because he wants to try and win people over to being techno-optimists. Now, I think that anything more than, because one of the people that is going to get cited in this is Nietzsche, right? Friedrich Nietzsche. And I notice a kind of stylistic resemblance between this and Nietzsche, where Nietzsche will use this, he will say we immoralists all the time. He's trying to anticipate people who in the future will feel the same way that Nietzsche feels about these. And he's trying to kind of almost like put his arm around the reader in a certain way. He's doing a lot of rhetoric, which that Nietzsche understands he's doing that. And he understands that it is psychological, you know, Nietzsche's a psychologist. But I think kind of, you know, me taking a jab a little bit at this, that's probably the most that this gets out of Nietzsche is the rhetorical style. Any substance or ideas that it actually gets from Nietzsche, either it gets wrong or aren't actually like, you know, Nietzschean ideas at all. It's just the idea of like the manifesto style of saying, hey, we're going to make this as wide as possible so you can feel included when you are reading this, right?
Yeah, and I think that there's an interesting poke through a more personalized, you know, you've got the we, we've got the R, obviously, you know, I think he's got certain people in his mind, but he's being inclusive. But there is one line in the section of truth where it goes, I'm here to bring the good news. It's a very Judeo-Christian flourish. And it's also, I think, quite revealing of the author, right? The author is here to bring us, you know, the good news. He's got the great answer. He's got the kind of, he's got the revelation, right? And the revelation is to be a techno-optimist. But, you know, to think of yourself as, you know, the bringer of good news.
There's already a lot of ego involved for a problem that you're more or less manufacturing in the first section, right? Where in the real world, there's a lot of nuance being weighed back and forth about pros and cons for this kind of technology. I mean, you know, being kind of a bit of a McLuhanist, I understand that, you know, the gun doesn't shoot itself, right? These things have real like effects, like the mediums do have effects, so it's not just that there's a pro or con or whatever, but there's more nuance to that. But the case is, like, the point of the first section is to say there are techno-pessimists, and then there are this point of the next section is to say there are techno-optimists and you should be a techno-optimist. But that's a manufactured problem. He's making a problem and then selling you the solution. One, two.
Yeah, yeah, we're making this. But and it's interesting as well, before we go on to the next section, he says, for hundreds of years, we properly glorified this until recently. First of all, going back to the same sort of thing, sure, there are Luddites out there. There are some people who have Luddite proclivities, maybe even me a little bit. But I seriously do not think that these people are, you know, at the center of power and political decision. That does not seem to be the case at all. In fact, the opposite. And as well, for hundreds of years, we've probably glorified technology, use technology. What's been one of the primary pushers of technology over, you know, the last few eons of, you know, quite rapid human development. For, I mean, one of the most obvious ones is war, right? Violence is when a, you know, a real pressure cooker for technological development. So there's this kind of, there's a very glossing over of what technology is. That's not to say technology is good or bad. From my perspective, the technology just is, I agree on some sense in the opening lines, our civilization was built on technology, our civilization is built on technology. That is, like, ostensibly true, but it's not a necessarily a, you know, moral acquiescence one way or the other to technology itself. Technology just is a thing that humans do.
Yeah. There's also, you know, if you kind of think about the, you know, past the black and white dichotomy that has been set up for you, and you just think about the actual discourses that it's trying to obfuscate, you know, we are told that technology threatens our health, ruins the environment, degrades our society. Well, if you think about the people who are arguing that there are certain technologies that certainly do this, there's another side of this that says, well, there are things like sustainable technologies like solar power and wind power and geothermal, who people would be very enthusiastic about those technologies, and people would very much so glorify those as commendable achievements because they are, you know, they're sort of technology without the folly in a certain way. But those people would not be the kinds of people that Andreessen is trying to include in his our civilization, right? He doesn't really want sustainability. He wants growth, right?
Yeah, we'll see. Well, why don't we jump right in and find out for sure from this one. So the next section is titled Technology. So Mark Andreessen goes on, techno-optimists believe that societies like sharks grow or die. Interesting metaphor. the choice of shark was very interesting. We believe growth is progress leading to vitality, expansion of life, increasing knowledge, higher well-being. This is giving me the numbers have never been higher vibes already. But I'll go on. We agree with Paul Collier when he says, economic growth is not cure-all, but lack of growth is a kill-all. We believe everything good is downstream of growth. We believe not growing is stagnation, which leads to zero-sum thinking, internal fighting, degradation, collapse, and ultimately death. Oh, very ominous. There are only three sources of growth: population growth, natural resource utilization, and technology. Developed societies are depopulating all over the world across cultures. The total human population may already be shrinking. I don't think that's true, but natural resource utilization has sharp limits, both real and political. And so only perpetual source of growth is technology. In fact, technology, new knowledge, new tools, what the Greeks called techne, has always been the main source of growth, and perhaps only the only cause of growth, as technology made both population growth and natural resource utilization possible. We believe technology is a lever on the world, a way to make more with less. Economists measure technological progress by productivity growth, how much more we can produce each year with fewer inputs, fewer raw materials. Productivity growth powered by technology is a main driver of economic growth, wage growth, and the creation of new industries and jobs, as people and capital are continuously free to do more important, valuable things than in the past. Productivity growth causes prices to fall, supplies to rise, and demand to expand, improving the material well-being of the entire population. We believe this is the story of material development of our civilization. This is why we are not still living in mud huts, eking out a meager survival and waiting for nature to kill us all. We believe this is why our descendants will live in the stars. We believe there is no material problem, whether created by nature or by technology, that cannot be solved with more technology. we had a problem of starvation, so we invented the Green Revolution. We had a problem of darkness, we invented electric light. We had a problem of cold, so we invented indoor heating. We had a problem of heat, so we invented air conditioning. We had a problem of isolation, so we invented the internet. That's a hilarious example. We had a problem of pandemics, so we invented vaccines. We had a problem of poverty, so we invented technology to create abundance. Give us a real world problem, we can invent technology that will solve it. Yeah, so this is an enormous pump up of because I think the subtext of all this is look, like, technology is the only way forward, obviously, is what he's saying. Population is growth is going down or whatever. You can't go on forever. Apparently, they like it both ways. It's going down, but it's also they want it to go up, but they can't decide. Natural resources are limited. What about mining the moon or Mars, Elon? Whatever happened to that idea. But anyways, so the only thing to do is basically to get technology to accelerate. So this is where we get to the overtly accelerationist aspect of this, which is basically Merck and Dreessen, a lot of these people are obviously accelerationists. For those of you who don't know, any kind of accelerationism is just the ideology that, like, whatever your particular thing is, you want to kind of push the gas on that modality. So with technological accelerationism, you really are just like, no, we should be all the way 100% gas down on sort of advancing technology. That's the solution to everything. My first initial thought with reading this is, okay, you immediately get this kind of, you know, Blade Runner sort of vibe of like, well, who's going to do that? Who controls technology? Who does that kind of influence? It's obviously very specific and a small number of corporations and, you know, tech billionaires and people like that. Those are the people leading the charge. Those are the people in charge of this process, right? Like, this is your only option. Hand it over to us because we're going to accelerate, you know, the machine to solve all the problems, and we're the only ones that can do it.
My understanding of accelerationism was that it was like a sort of anti-capitalist extremism. Because the idea was that since capitalism is like, there was this idea of capitalist realism that we can't imagine a world without capitalism. And capitalism contains like this inherent contradiction where we're going to essentially use up everything in order to sort of produce stuff that we need. But we have finite resources, so we're just going to eventually reach this endpoint, right? Well, accelerationists advocated for the end of capitalism by saying, well, just reach that endpoint as fast as possible. It'll destroy the world, but at least capitalism will be over. So accelerationism was like originally an anti-capitalist idea, but this is overtly pro-capitalist by saying, well, this is how civilizations grow, through growth and productivity and efficiency and whatnot. So, and we had to keep doing this, right? I don't think that Merck and Dreessen is an anti-capitalist, so the accelerationist angle is kind of interesting, but it's this obvious belief that that contradiction doesn't exist, right? Because we can live among the stars. We have to keep growing, and if we don't, we just die.
It sets up a very, this kind of ominous, like, you know, we have to keep growing. If we don't, we're going to die. It's all going to fall apart. So, like, look, you have to let the people who can do the things that need to be done do what they need to do. And so it's basically, again, getting this kind of like background narrative of like, get out of our way, right? Like, get out of our way. Let us, you know, proceed however we need to proceed with our technological innovation and economic, you know, whatever, and corporate growth, because that's how, you know, things are done. So, for example, he listed all these problems that were solved by technology, and the best one was we had a problem with isolation, so we invented the internet. People probably feel much more isolated now than they did in the 1960s or whatever, in many cases. But it's also this weird kind of one where it's like, well, what if there's aspects of technology that are the problem? You're listing all these very sort of like human natural issues that technology is overcoming, but if a technology is an issue, then how are you going to solve that? Like, an example of that was obviously, like, think about nuclear weapons. That problem has not been solved, right? Like, we now just have a world where everybody has, or a whole bunch of countries have, I should say, a blow up the world button, and nobody's pressing it because, you know, it's mutually assured destruction. But it's not like left us in a better position necessarily than, you know, had nuclear weapons never been invented. There's some people who are going to argue, oh, well, it stops wars and all that kind of stuff. But it's like, that seems like a supervillain solution to stopping something like war, is to create a super weapon that will kill everybody. So there's,
it's a very accelerationist solution. You just reach the logical contradiction and then you sort of float at that endpoint where nothing can happen, right? At least hostilities are not overt. You know, it's why Cold Wars happened, or it's why the Cold War occurred in light of the nuclear weapon. It had to be a war of proxy wars and political subterfuge and whatnot. Yeah, war was kind of sublimated in a certain way, right? One of the other people that Mark Andreessen is going to cite here is Nick Land. I haven't read Nick Land or anything, but I know an anecdote of him where at a conference he gave a talk where he more or less just blasted jungle music and was screaming into a microphone. And one of the people in the audience got up and said, you know, some of us are still Marxists, you know. Now, to this, I will say, to this idea of growth and infinite expansion and whatnot, this idea that we're going to get to the stars and that there just is no limit, to that, I say to this piece, some of us are still Greeks, okay? Some of us really do still believe in this idea of limit and finitude, that things have a point at which they can fall apart. Right. This piece doesn't show any idea that, like, you can go too big. It's just grow or die. There is no like homeostatic point of civilization where you reach a certain kind of equilibrium between the organism and the environment, and that relationship is the limit of that thing, right? It's about power and it's about overcoming whatever boundaries that are established, right? Like any kind of state of homeostasis is just stagnation, waiting for someone else to come along and eat you up. Maybe that's why Mark Andreessen is talking about, he's using sharks as an analogy. You have to be the big shark that eats the little fish because there are bigger fish out there. You got to get bigger, right? It's a kind of like competitive paranoia in a certain way, this idea that, you know, okay, Mark Andreessen, you're like a billionaire, but there's bigger billionaires out there who could buy you out, or I don't think they do that. They don't fight
well,
with
I think,
money like that.
Well, here, let's jump down to the section as we, you know, come to the last like 10 minutes of the show. We'll jump down to the section, becoming a technological Superman. I'll read it out here. It's a little bit shorter. We believe that advancing technology is one of the most virtuous things that we can do. We believe in deliberately and systematically transforming ourselves into the kind of people who can advance technology. We believe this certainly means a technical education, but it also means going hands-on, gaining practical skills, working within leading teams, inspiring to build something greater than oneself, aspiring to work with others to build something greater as a group. We believe that natural human drive to make things, to gain territory, to explore the unknown can be channeled productively into building technology. We believe that while the physical frontier, at least on Earth, is closed, technological frontier is wide open. We believe in exploring and claiming technological frontier. We believe in the romance of technology, of industry, the eros of the train, the car, the electric light, the skyscraper, the microchip, the neural network, the rocket, the split atom. We believe in adventure, undertaking the hero's journey, rebelling against the status quo, mapping uncharted territory, conquering dragons, bringing home spells for our community. To paraphrase a manifesto of a different time and place, beauty exists only in struggle. There is no masterpiece that has not an aggressive character. Technology must be a violent assault on the forces of the unknown to force them to bow before man. We believe that we are here, have been, and will always be the masters of technology, not mastered by technology. Victim mentality is a curse in every domain of life, including our relationship with technology, both unnecessary and self-defeating. We are not victims, we are conquerors. We believe in nature, but we also believe in overcoming nature. We are not primitive, cowering in fear of lightning bolt. We are apex predators. The lightning works for us. We believe in greatness. We admire the great technologists and the industrialists who came before us, and we aspire to make them proud of us today. We believe in humanity individually and collectively. It sounds like wish casting. There's also this all this BS about, like, you know, for the collective and some of us. This is very clearly aimed at there are specific kinds of people, i.e. techno-optimist supermen, who can drive the frontier, who should be in charge, who are, you know, who will go beyond, who will transcend the human form. Yeah, it's turning the entrepreneur into the hero's journey, and, you know, some sort of, like, you know, Elon the Achilles type, you know, character, right? And it's very, like, it's very telling, even in the status quo, mapping uncharted territory, conquering dragons and bringing the spoils home for our community, or what do you say, the victim mentality is a curse. We are not victims, we are conquerors. It's sort of like negating, it's basically saying, like, look, if you are having any negative experiences with technology, if it's harming you in any kind of way, whatever the technology is, you are wrong. Like, if that's not real, you're not strong enough, you're not one of us. There's a certain select group of people who can kind of carry this fire, carry this torch, and progress, like, as far and as possible as we should, and no one should get in our way. This obviously prerequisites power. Like, this is just basically saying, like we should have the power to do whatever we want. We have the capabilities to do whatever we want, and we're going to do whatever we want.
I mean, obviously, like, the ego involved in this is enormous. It's not just from ego, though. I do think that it is a kind of, like, okay, it's ego insofar as it is like getting high on your own supply, right? Marc Andreessen is, like, a venture capitalist. He's used to propping up projects that either they make money for him and that's great, or they crash and burn and it doesn't matter because you move on to the next thing and that just makes up for your losses. So it is this kind of, like, very Darwinian process in that way. But that's kind of the source of it, is, like, we kind of just have the money and the power to throw around. And if you don't have power to be able to go out and do this, then this is not going to be a project that you can pick up. This is not an ethos that you can literally embody. Now, I think that does go to the point of, like, him trying to evoke this idea of a technological Superman. You know, he's trying to use Nietzsche's idea of the Übermensch, who kind of also presupposes having, like, a surplus energy to be able to use on the world. And in that way, it's a kind of overflowing. That's what's super about it. So it's not hidden that this is a kind of character of abundance, but that doesn't mean that it's a character of, you know, technological flourishing or actually, like, giving back to a community or anything like that. The goal is actually presupposed in the condition for the goal, right? You already have to have the thing to do. How do I make sense of this? Like, you get what I'm saying, right? To be able to be this, to be this Superman, to propagate all this new technology, you already have to be powerful. And in the world we live in right now, you have to be positioned within the technological world in order to propagate this technology. So it's not just ego, but it's even, like, structurally self-congratulating and self-fulfilling in that way.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as we close out, because we don't have a few minutes left, but at the near the end, to kind of get back to that, there's a little bit more, and people can read the essay if they want. You get a lot of the same vibes, but at the end, there's some patron saints of techno-optimism. He gives this list of, I guess, people that he likes. And at the right before we started the episode, I brought up that I thought it was interesting that Ayn Rand was on this list, because this is an extremely objectivist Ayn Randian feeling piece. But then you pointed out that actually one of the listed characters or people that he lists is John Galt, who is the main character of Ayn Rand's primary novel, Shrug. And John Galt's whole story is about him, you know, basically pushing aside everyone else to pursue his goals and dreams because he's some sort of like ubermensch, right? And so I think that that's, as you said, he's some sort of like billionaire ubermensch guy who like he controls the fastest trains or whatever. I read the novel like over a decade ago and I'm never going to read it again. But, you know, the point is that, you know, he has to get past all these socialists and so-called cretins and people like that to pursue his dreams and goals, which are superb and incredible because he's some sort of super genius and all-powerful and all that kind of stuff. And it just seems like they kind of view themselves in a very similar way, right? There's a bunch of people trying to stop them. They're not going to stop us. We're too powerful. We have too much control. But you should feel bad for us because, like, John Galt is also played as this kind of, like, you should feel bad for him because, like, people are trying to stop him from doing so much, like, good for himself. You know, like, so there's this victim mentality. But yet at the same time, anybody who isn't on their side or can't handle their tech or gets negative effects from, you know, technological development is somehow, like, a weakling and not worthwhile. Right. And it's, you know, just it's a victim. And so they're, you know, they're playing both sides. And at the end of the day, it's a extremely self-interested project.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it contains its contradiction in that way. Right. It makes me think of this contradiction that you can find in the Gorgias, in Plato's Gorgias with Callicles. Right. He claims that the great are like lions and they can eat, you know, their prey, that they have the natural right to dominate those who are weaker. But then he also has he has to explain why he's oppressed, as a strong person. And it's that the weak can band together to, suppress and oppress the strong. So there are these contradictions where it's like, you're strong and powerful, but also people can hold you down, right? So which one is it? Like, if you're so strong, you should be able to overcome these odds. And I guess this is one of those kind of pushes to try and overcome what is perceived as like a collective threat to the individual. But like the contradiction is there, right? Power is, you know, power is in the act. If you can't do it, then you're not powerful. You can't claim that you have a natural right.
This has been a wonderful episode of the Canadian Philosophy Show.
You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
Listening to CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. The support from our awesome community helps keeping the station diverse and independent. Thank you.
This is Bird Note. What are these strange clicking sounds? Is this a secret message in Morse code? They're the calls of a male buff-breasted sandpiper courting a female on their breeding grounds far north of the Arctic Circle. He raises his wings, flashing their silvery white undersides as he sings his clicking serenade. A bit smaller than a robin, the buff-breasted sandpiper is strikingly handsome, rich tawny brown overall, with dark markings on the back and the light-colored breast for which it's named. And it's a shapely bird. Fine. Delicate, almost. It'll spend much of the year on grasslands in Argentina, migrating to the Arctic in late spring for breeding, then heading south again in late summer or early fall. In the lower 48, September's a good time to look for this long-distance traveler. During migration, they show a distinct preference for grassy expanses such as pastures and rice fields. Buff-breasted sandpipers are one of our scarcest shorebirds, and they face threats from pesticides and the loss of habitat. Joint conservation among the U.S., Canada, and Argentina under the Migratory Species Convention could greatly benefit this bird. But even small actions, like supporting growers of organic rice, can help secure the future of a threatened species, like the buff-breasted sandpiper. For BirdNote, I'm Mary McCann.